Accession number 312, Miss Farnborough, Reel 11.
Did medical problems change as the war progressed, and you find you had more head injuries or more amputations or...
Well, it depended whether we were advancing or retreating. In 1915, when we retreated for 5.5 months, mostly by night, because by day the aeroplanes of the enemy were deadly, but by night it was constant retreat for 5.5 months, and then, of course, nothing that we could ever dream of could change the enormous quantity of wounds that we met with during those months. I think every variety of wound came our way. I don't think that anything that could have been shown us in later years could have excelled in suffering or excelled in horror those wounds that we saw while we were retreating. And then again, in 1916, when we advanced, there was a different kind of wound. We looked after and tended the dying and the dead and those who were only lightly wounded on the battlefield, because we were advancing and we were behind our soldiers in their wake. When they advanced, we advanced. The battlefields that they had once been so full of activity and horror now were quiet, just littered with dead bodies and completely smashed wire entanglements. Even the trees themselves told their story. Many of them, especially the big forest trees, were terribly mutilated. And the trunks were shaven down, and the great tree branches were thrown here and there due to the great and dreadful cannonade that had swept over them. It seems ironic, but it both were dreadful. I had thought when we were advancing, when we shall advance, before we had advanced, that now the glory of our warfare would be seen in all its wonder and gratitude, because I thought, now advancing, that can only mean victory, victory, and defeat of our enemies. But it wasn't. I think walking over those battlefields perhaps were an experience so terrible, so indescribably terrible, that it would never be possible to explain in ordinary words. One had to be there to see all that was left behind, the debris of the battlefield, men's crumpled bodies here and there, great pools of stained earth, bits of clothing on the wire entanglements, guns thrown here, mutilation there. I don't think one can describe it really. I tried to describe in my book, but I know it was badly done. Perhaps in a way I am glad, because it was very, very difficult to describe it. It was very difficult in any case to write my book, because by writing my book I went back to war again. And to go back to war, to go to war when one is young and strong and longing for experience in life, it doesn't seem quite so dreadful as when one is old, more sensitive, and realizes to the full all the terror and misery and suffering that warfare can bring in its train. Dreadful. It was dreadful, too, to see that the Austrians themselves had left their victims behind. The casualties were there. We came across many of them. The Austrians hadn't been able probably not had time to take them with them. The Russians wouldn't bother about them. They were enemies. But in many, many dugouts we saw them, in many. And then one asks oneself, so this is victory. Just these mouldering bodies can testify to the victory of Russian, can prove to the Russians that we are advancing.
Then, on the other hand, in defeat, you'd be going through unmarked countryside that was as if there'd never been a war.
Yes, and the difficulty then was we knew the enemy was at our heels. What we had hoped to see were reinforcements and also fortifications, but in many parts of Russia, no fortified places were to be found. And then when we had to retreat even to Grodno, the famous old historical fortress of Russia, even there they were dismantling the forts because they knew they couldn't hold out against the enormous manpower that was sweeping towards Grodno. And before we left Grodno, they were blowing up these forts that had been built over the centuries as a safeguard, as an invulnerable fortress for the Russians.
What sort of equipment was there in those hastily set up first aid stations on retreat? I mean, did you have everything ready in special boxes and drawers and something? I'm constantly impressed in your book with how quickly you're able to stop and set up and then, if necessary, pack everything away and go on again.
Well, every one of us had a knapsack. We didn't bother about our stuff. Our own private clothing and stuff and came off to us. We had what we call the sister's lorry or furmanka, carrying our own personal belongings. That remained with us wherever we went, when it was possible to follow us. But we had also our knapsacks, which were filled with first aid packets containing lint and wadding and iodine and everything that was necessary for a first aid dressing. And then, too, with us would come the hospital orderlies. We all kept together, not only we four surgical sisters. The housekeeping sister, our fifth sister, she never came with us, not unless we were all retreating together. But we four surgical sisters would go perhaps with a company of 20 to 30 hospital orderlies, all trained in dressing wounds. I must say, very often we were able to instruct them what to do. In times of difficulty, they worked on their own because there was no time to ask questions or even to receive an answer. But they were all trained, and they were wonderful men, wonderfully reliable, and men that one knew would do their very, very best for their wounded, no matter were it friend or foe. I've often thought that was very wonderful because many Russians, I can imagine, were very embittered against the enemy. But there were times when there was no suggestion of even discriminating or asking, are you friend or foe? We all worked. Sometimes we knew that it was not a Russian, a foreigner. Good, a foreigner. But it's a man who's wounded. Well, his wound must be dressed and cleaned.
How did those men come to be orderlies? Were they too old, or were they not fit for service, or was their qualification such that it would have been foolish for them to be soldiers when they had a medical background?
No, I don't think I never asked that question, because I know even in England there are people who dedicate their lives from very early years to helping in hospitals and disaster places where disaster has taken. But I do know that these men had all received training, and they were called, actually, in Russian, sanitar. Now, a sanitar, if you look up in your dictionary, you will find it means hospital, orderly. That is to say, a man trained as a kind of hospital nurse. Here, I'm sure there are many hospital nurses in England, men. And these men in time of war would continue their work. They would not be recruited as soldiers. I can't understand how it could be that every man, because he was a man, would have to be a soldier. We couldn't have done without our doctors. We couldn't have done without our dispensers. We couldn't have done without our orderlies. We couldn't have done without our transport people, our ambulance people. We consisted of about 200 people, and we were 4 surgical sisters. And those other men were essential to our work, to our lives, the front, and to the lives of our wounded men.
Were any of them conscientious objectors?
If they had been, they didn't make mention of it. Just a wee bit wearying, you know, when I throw myself into the war again, I feel a kind of sort of despair come over me. As long as I speak clearly and you know what I want to say. But I'm not enjoying it. You can't enjoy it. And I've done it so often. I've done it for nearly a year now. I'm hoping it will end soon. But you're very sweet about it. You take it very gently. I've had some more difficult ones than you. I had one from the BBC who came and wanted to do it all in Russian. And one of his first questions was, "Now, Miss Farmer," he was English but spoke beautifully Russian. And he said, "Now tell me this and that," and I had to tell him in Russian, "describe the political atmosphere of Russia before the First World War in Moscow." Well, they're not difficult, your question.
How did you sterilise things?
Well, there again, I don't think we did it very often. It was done by one of the orderlies. We were too busy, you know. Provided the material was there for us, sterilised when we needed it, we didn't ask who did it. But you see, there was quite a big company of us. And you are making out as though we 4 sisters bore the brunt of it all. Really, I think we did play a principal part because we were chosen women. But don't forget, there were dozens and dozens of young, able, educated, intelligent men around us who were playing their part. And just one more thing you've never mentioned, and that I would like you to know, that despite all the misery and the suffering and the violence of our everyday life, there were intermixed with that many countless acts of tremendous heroism and self-sacrifice among our own men. We knew of it, we accepted it, we never mentioned it, nor did they mention it. Just now and then it came to our knowledge. But if I had had time, instead of writing a book, I could have written down the countless acts of heroism and self-sacrifice which took place daily during the retreat and daily during the advance. I could have written a dozen books instead of one.
Are there any particular examples that just come to mind at the moment?
If there were, I wouldn't like to repeat them now, because in many cases they passed unnoticed, yet not completely unnoticed. for the person themselves often paid the full price of that heroism.